Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. I'm going to bring on the first caller this evening. I think this is Nate, 949.
Hello.
Is this Nate?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How are you this evening?
Pretty good.
I am in a strange mood, my friend. As you can tell by that film I sent you, right?
Yeah.
I'm pretty bad off this evening. How did I get to this point? Well, that's a good question. I was studying today the might of the thoughts, and heaven help the person that's new to the show, because we're going to do a little bit of a strange show this evening, I think. Billy Meyer, Edward Albert Meyer, is a farmer from Switzerland. He lives in a tiny mountain village called Hinterschmidbruti. He's in his late 70s. He's written 39 books. We're going to talk about one of his books this evening called The Might of the Thoughts. And on page 276, he's talking about belief. And he says, in this way, belief has an extraordinarily strong hypnotic effect. And it leads to inconsiderateness, illogic, and to fanaticism, as well as to bondage. So I'm going to play a clip, probably starting off here in a little bit, that shows some of the hypnotic effects of that appears in some of the televangelist stuff. So let me dive right into this, and we'll get Nate to comment on a little bit of this as we continue here. Nate, are you clicking around? I'm hearing some noise there.
No, you should be on mute.
Okay. Anyway, here we go.
I love religious TV.
What fools the nations are to rage against the Lord.
I'm a channel surfing, religious TV, couch potato fool. I once sat in a motel room in Meridian, Mississippi, watching a Pentecostal revival meeting that lasted 3.5 hours, and they didn't even use snakes.
Your sins have to pop out somewhere.
Nate, now you said you've seen this before, haven't you? Excuse me. You've watched some of these, this particular clip, correct?
Yeah, I think it's this one. A while back, yeah. There's some.
Go ahead.
One of the things that I found really interesting is kind of their very. I don't know. It's like they're very wicked. You know, I think towards the end of this clip, the guy's saying $1,000 now. Something like that.
You know, it's interesting that in this book that Billy has written, he talks about hypnosis and belief having a strong hypnotic effect. And now belief is confidence in the truth or existence of something that is not immediately susceptible to rigorous proof. So instead of belief, the Meyer information says we should work towards knowledge. In fact, hypnosis is the induction of a state of consciousness in which a person apparently loses the power of voluntary action. Now, this is important to understand, because under hypnosis, it seems to undermine our free will, and a person becomes highly responsive to suggestion. And that's what these televangelists use. Whether they know it or not, they're using a form of hypnosis to put their listeners, their watchers, into this state of highly responsiveness to suggestion. Hypnotic drugs are a class of drugs that are designed to put you to sleep. And hypnosis is a state of the human consciousness where you have focused attention and reduce peripheral awareness, again, characterized by an enhanced capacity for response to suggestion. Now, again, some of these sentences are so packed with information. And it says here, in this way, belief has an extraordinary strong hypnotic effect, leads to inconsiderateness, illogic, and to the fanaticism as well as bondage. A fanatic is motivated or characterized by an extreme uncritical enthusiasm or zeal. And fanatics can appear in religion or politics. So anyway, the road to getting to this state is belief. Now, it also says here that belief leads to illogic. So what is logic? If belief is leading to illogic, logic is the science that investigates the principles governing correct and reliable inference. Logic is the study of valid reasoning. Let me give you an example. We'll use deductive reasoning, an example of a deductive argument. You have an if A, then B situation. First of all, we say all men are mortal. That's a true statement. Now you say, if Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. So that's a simple example of using deductive reasoning. Now belief shuts down this deductive reasoning process. And it leads you to a state of being estranged, alienated from the objective world. And the Meyer stuff says belief is based on wrong and negative thinking and in the rejection and displacement of reality, whereby every believer is restricted in the creation of new and progressive ideas, intentions, imaginations, and wishes, and so forth, and becomes estranged from the real facts of life. So if you live a life based on belief, it can make you estranged from the real facts of life. You'll become alienated. Religion sometimes can alienate us from the facts of life. Now, that clip that I'm playing is such an extreme example of this. And it's gone so far in our society today. And we have televangelists all over the place. Kenneth Copeland is the perfect example of one. These guys make millions and millions of dollars by putting their congregations in this hypnotic state where they can be highly suggestible, and they will make these incredible donations. Let's listen to Kenneth Copeland here for a second. I think there's a little quiet here at the beginning of this clip. Kenneth Copeland.
No denying some people have prospered handsomely.
Wow!
The pastors themselves. They live like rock stars with huge mansions, private jets, and fancy cars.
Oh, yeah!
But when it comes to opulence, few religious leaders compare to Kenneth Copeland.
Amen.
To show you his house, we rented a helicopter. helicopter so you can see his 18,000 square foot mansion valued at over $6 million.
He lives in this home outside Fort Worth, Texas. It has beautiful water views and comes complete with a boathouse. But that's not all. Copeland is an avid pilot, and here's his pride and joy, a $20 million Cessna Citation jet. It's the fastest private jet money can buy. He said he needed it to better serve the Lord, and proudly did a flyby for his followers after the church bought it.
Shout amen!
But it's not just one plane. We found a fleet of planes registered to the church. And you won't catch him waiting in line at the airport because he's got his own, the Kenneth Copeland Airport, located right next to his mansion.
I think Copeland is unbelievably greedy.
Amen.
She sent them a lot of money, a whole lot of money.
When Christy Parker's mother died of cancer, she found diaries that showed her mother sent Copeland most of her life savings, hoping her faith and donations would cure her of her terminal disease.
What do you think of Kenneth Copeland's lifestyle?
TV doesn't do it justice. Their office furniture is probably worth more than most people's houses. It makes you sick.
Oh, amen.
My lifestyle follows the scripture. We give, we believe. We're open.
You have a fleet of private jets. Why is that necessary? You're a minister. How many private jets do you have?
We're open. We're open.
Right after that, he walked away.
Anyway, Kenneth Copeland is another example of these televangelists. 18,000 square foot mansion. Copeland has a $20 million Cessna jet and a fleet of planes. Nate, it's interesting that the Meyer material warns us about materialism, and this conversation could go a whole bunch of different directions if we talk about materialism, but it's interesting that religion in this case also manifests in the excess of materialism. Could you comment on that?
I would think so. I think that certain people understand that it's basically a con, and they've understood it at a very young age. In fact, there's a great documentary that came out in the 1970s. It was called Marjo. And you would think that that documentary would have busted the whole televangelism wide open, but it didn't, you know. And I think that leads to a lot of people's being under a state of hypnosis and whatnot. And in your description of what, like, belief is, one of the things that you kind of said, it leads to irrational thinking. And earlier on in the Billy and Asket contact reports, Billy went underneath the Giza pyramids, and he was presented with some artifacts, I guess the Spirit Destiny, and the Crown of Thorns, and I think there was one other artifact there. But they were all fabrications. But at that time, Billy goes, oh, no, the whole thing is true. And he did that for a reason, to kind of rid him of his last dwindling belief system. Because I guess he was also, you know, he was also raised in a religious society.
It's amazing the power of these religions. And like you said, even though so many of these guys have been exposed for all these extremes, and I mean, they just, it's just a huge, huge absurdity. We see behavior that's just absurd. People acting in strange, bizarre ways. It seems to affect people in the most profound ways. Billy talks about, and I don't mean to do this to attack anyone's religion at all, but Billy has a book, and I've only read parts of it, and because I don't have the whole book yet, and it's still in German. But Marianne Eulinger Mondrian has been good enough to translate parts of it. And the book is called God, Delusion, and Sanity. And we talk about a universal consciousness. There is a universal consciousness. There is a superintelligence, a neutral positive entity that radiates love, but it is not a God. It doesn't look over you. It doesn't direct your life. It doesn't have any of the anthropomorphic qualities that our religions have ascribed to the creator of all things. It doesn't become vengeful. It doesn't claim that that revenge is it isn't a jealous God. It doesn't get involved in human affairs. But the gods of our religions are really the inventions of human beings, the inventions of the human brain. And religion is actually something that's handed down. And somehow, when we focus on delusion, it creates a kind of insanity. Schizophrenia, not schizophrenia in the normal sense that most people think of split personality and multiple personality disorder, but schizophrenia really is a mental disorder that has a failure to recognize what is real. It's important to realize that the gods that have been invented by religions are not real in that sense. I think there was in the ancient past here on the earth, there were extraterrestrials that, as it says in the book of OM, the gods of the earth were human, and they created religions and they demanded worship. And somehow, heredity and religion are related. And let me read something from God Delusion and Sanity here. It says, apart from certain hereditary diseases, religious delusion and sanity, and all kinds of addictions can also be passed on because these factors have nothing to do with the consciousness evolution of the new person. But these are mental degeneracies of the respective progenitors that settle in the brains of the fetus. And as for the example of the God delusion in the temporal lobe and in the parietal lobe, and the addiction in the so-called dependence or addiction center, just the way a child can be an addict if the mother is an addict, so the child can also be religious if the mother is very, very religious. Now, Nate was talking about Askett's explanations, and Askett was Billy's second extraterrestrial mentor. And she talks about the delusions generated by the Giza intelligences. And for thousands of years, they deceived the Earth humans with religious miracles and visions of every kind in order to maintain and yet further increase the religious delusion. And out of these grounds, they have also created a mighty station under the Pyramid of Giza in order to guide from there the religious delusional events of the Earth. Now, in addition to the schizophrenic kind of insanity, which is really a divorcement from reality, not a split personality, also there is a kind of epilepsy that's passed on. And this epilepsy is a group of neurological disorders characterized by seizures. Epileptic seizures are episodes that can vary from brief to long periods of vigorous shaking. And if it's interesting that if you look at people in extreme religion, it seems to come over them almost like a seizure sometimes. And you see in the examples of the televangelists healing people and the people falling over, and then when I played the clip there at the beginning where the guy is acting like a chicken or something, I don't know what he's doing. But these they're almost like seizures when they come over people.
Yeah, I have a friend that actually went to one of these I guess they have a harvest thing down near my house. They handle it at the Angel Stadium, ironically. He was going up on stage, and the person taking him up says, okay, he's going to touch you. We need you to fall back. I mean, you'll feel the Holy Spirit, but you might not feel it as strong as everybody else, and we'll catch you. Don't worry about it. So when he touches your head, make sure you fall back. So a lot of those people that, you know, go up there, you know, they're just happen to be bystanders in the crowd. Yeah, they're like, okay, yeah, they're coached, which you know, further sells the delusion, which was, you know, and we kind of mentioned how this can start with kids and start young. In the chat room, I dropped a link if anybody wants to read it. And that was a rebuttal I had, or not a rebuttal. Oh, yeah, I guess you could call it a rebuttal to my experience, my kid's daycare. She went kind of near my house, but mostly Hispanic ladies that worked there and stuff. But they're, you know, the head poncho over there, she was highly religious. And I picked up my kid one day, and she was talking, and she's like, Dad, you know where clouds come from? So I start going into an explanation of clouds. And then she's like, no, Dad, God makes clouds. And I'm like, what? Where'd you learn that? You know, and then she said, my instructor, Miss Angelica or something. And I kind of like, okay, maybe this was just a fluke. Maybe it was some other. But, you know, a few weeks later, she had her graduation for the summer. Basically, it's a daycare, but they have graduation because some of the kids are not going to be coming again next year because they'll be starting real school. So at the graduation, the head poncho over there, I don't want to call her poncho, but, you know, the head director, yeah, that's what it is. She got up there and she started, you know, talking about God and all this stuff, and had her minister come up, and I go, and I was just livid at that point. I just wanted to get out of there, and, you know, I didn't know my kid was getting an education that, you know, in belief, and that, you know, I try to be neutral with her as best I can, but, you know, So, yeah, I pulled out of there. My wife got mad at me for my comments, but whatever. So, but if anybody's interested in the chat room, there's a link to the letter I wrote to school.
So you didn't really want your child exposed to religion then, right?
No, I don't. I don't mind exposure to beliefs from other kids. I don't mind her having conversations on a level, you know, that she can communicate back. You know, kids are impressionable, and one of the things kids will trust adults. They trust adults because
right.
That's part of their, you know, survival mechanism. Here, you know, and just imagine a mom trying to, you know, breastfeed her kid, and her kid's not trusting. Nope, that's not a breast. You know, so it's kind of built in, And she's developing her rational thinking, her logical thinking, her ability to question and reason. She's developing all those, and, you know, she has an honest inquiry into things. And if I don't know something, I will tell her, I don't know. Let's go find out. Or I don't know, I don't have time right now, but we'll look later. You know, something that gives a promise of further inquiry and research and understanding. But her, I guess her instructors were just educated in the whole shut them down process. You know, if a question got too, and my mom used to do the same thing. She used to say, I would ask her about death and why do people have to die. And I did this when I was very young, and she said something about, oh, that's God's plan. And I'm like, what? You know, it was a shutdown. And anytime I tried to rational something out with her, she would play the God card on me. One of the favorite things that I loved was hearing when I totally disagreed or totally had an argument with her, and she said, yeah, well, did you know that all children choose their parents? You know,
she said that.
I'm like, yeah, we do? Yeah, so you got what you paid for. And I'm like, what? So, but, you know, basically it's just this mentality that kind of, you know, don't try to better your lot in life, especially if, you know, it deals with questioning God or, you know, any type of questioning of authority in certain instances.
Very interesting. I find it very interesting. Let's pick up here in this bizarre clip here. We'll just see some of the strangeness of religion. Here we go.
You do.
Did she say that's why acne is on their faces? What a babe, right? That was Sister Spring from, where is she from? Southern California somewhere, and we'll be seeing her later in the show. But hey, I'm Joe Bob Briggs, and it's time once again for Joe Bob's God Stuff, the show that brings the most entertaining TV preachers into your living room in Reader's Digest form. See, our philosophy is, a lot of these guys, you do want to see them, but you don't want to see that much of them, you know what I mean? Like Fred Phelps of Topeka, Kansas, the backbone of Bob Dole country. Please pay special attention. This is a good one. Pay attention to the rifle on Fred's set here.
Name was Gloria O'Dell. She ran against Bob, and she had support and large chunks of money coming into Kansas from these Now women and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force pouring money into Kansas to beat Bob Dole. We put big signs on the main thoroughfares of Kansas. We carried them with three words on them, Bull Dyke O'Dell. And when we got through with her, Pete, although the polls showed she was coming up and it was a neck-and-neck race, when we got through with her, she scarcely got one vote out of five.
That's great. Remember Christ said, marvel not that they hate you because they hated me first? You know, I would ask some of you out there, have you made an enemy for Christ these days?
Bull Dyke O'Dell. Is that two words or three? I think that's two words. So, come on with me, though. Let's review the past week in religious TV. As God said to Moses, let's boogie through the desert. And speaking of boogieing, you know, I always love this time of year because of that Lakayum Telethon they have in Southern California, the one hosted by Jan Murray and 9,000 bearded rabbis dancing the funky chicken. You ever see this? These guys dance like drunk soccer players. You know what I mean? They're all in danger of kicking one another in the butt at any time. Look at this.
Welcome to the 15th annual Lakayum to Life Telethon, starring Haki
Abasara. Anyway, they go on and they're really dancing around on the screen there. It's really kind of hard to believe, don't you think, Nate?
Yeah, well, actually, not really. Coming from where we come from and stuff. You know, that clip is very interesting because he admits to influencing the outcome of election and stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't even know, but what is the punishment for a nonprofit to, you know, they should lose their nonprofit status, right? They should now be taxable.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like the Kenneth Copeland thing and his Learjets, you know, and he's been investigated several times by the government. So, yeah, the big controversy is, should these guys really be nonprofit? I mean, come on now, you know, who needs a $20 million Learjet to be a preacher? But I guess they have their reasons. And they seem to be able to get away with it, and they seem to be able to keep their little flocks. So evidently, like the Meyer material says, belief has a very, very strong hypnotic effect. And as we've seen here, It really shuts down the logic portion of the brain. So these people, they shut down their ability to do any deductive reasoning. So they lose the ability to say, hey, well, if A is true, then we can logically go to B. So they're functioning on belief. And it seems to me that one of the big problems with religion, the problems with belief in general, functioning on belief rather than trying to go for knowledge, when you function on belief, it seems to interrupt the whole evolutionary process. And maybe because it shuts down logic, but it also seems to kind of lead to fanaticism and extremes. And we've talked a little bit about the Islamic extremists. And Billy's talked about the Islamic extremists in some of the more recent contacts. He's talked about a guy named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is now the leader of ISIS, the leader of all the fanaticized Islamists. And they're a real threat now. You know, at one time, I think we probably created them ourselves, whether on purpose or accidentally, I'm not sure. And now these people have taken control of Mosul and Syria and good parts of Iraq. And they have a serious intention to bring Sharia law all over the world. And the Sharia law is a tyranny. It's a tyranny that requires you to live a certain way where you pray five times a day, all sorts of rules regarding personal matters like sex and hygiene and diet and all sorts of tyranny. And it's really interesting because the Goblet of Truth says we live in a consciousness-conditioned tyranny, a tyranny that rose out of the military tyranny of the Roman Empire. And it's really interesting because here on the earth, we have really been a people subject to various kinds of tyranny. We had a kind of extraterrestrial tyranny that goes all the way back to the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria and the Giza intelligences. And then we had the rise of the Roman Empire and the military tyranny of the Roman Empire. And then we had the rise of the Roman Catholic Church. And then we had the auto de fe, where they burned people at the stake and they killed people who had different religious viewpoints. And Nate, you had said something the other day, I think it was on Revolution Radio, about how Islam was created to kind of stop the flow of Christianity. Because you said there would be no United States if Christianity hadn't been stopped. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. But Islam had to militarize against the oppressors at the time. And I think that was one of their main objectives. Of course, the teachings of the Spirit were also given down by Muhammad. But like Emmanuel's teachings, they were also corrupted. And, you know, in one of the prophets of Emmanuel, he talked about an evil cult, just like the evil cult that would rise around his teachings, that would also rise around Muhammad's teachings.
You know, if you look back at the beginning of monotheism, monotheism began in Egypt, and Amenhotep IV renamed himself to Akhenaten in kind of a reverence for the sun god. And we talked about this again on Revolution Radio last night. If you see a lot of the depictions of the Egyptians, particularly the Egyptian gods, like Ra will be seen with this orange circle above their head. It's kind of an icon. And we saw the same kind of icons appear in Christianity at different times. I've been reading an interesting book by a guy named Homer Smith. It's called Man and His Gods. And he talks a little bit about the gods of Egypt. And interestingly, I mean, one of Billy's contacts is called Ptah. And there was a Ptah in the Egyptian pantheon. He was a creator god. He is considered the demiurge who existed before all other things. And he said, the world was conceived by his thought, and he had certain abilities. He played a role in the preservation of the world. And I know in Contact Report 70, it talks about one of the Giza intelligences named Jehave, who ruled wickedly and screamed for blood and revenge. And that was about 3,320 years ago. And he sired three sons. One was named Erasim, the other Ptah, and the other Salam. Now, I don't know if this was a earlier lifetime of the same person, Ptah, or a different person entirely. But it's kind of interesting seeing this name pop up in history as well. Also in Egyptian mythology, there is a negative god, so to speak. His name is called Set, and he killed and mutilated his own brother, who was Osiris. And Set was kind of an evil god. He was a liar, a mischievous person, and there was contendings between Set and Osiris. It's very similar to Christianity with this conflict between Christ and the devil. It's almost like we're seeing the repeating of the same motifs hundreds and hundreds of years later, and these motifs can be traced all the way back to ancient Egypt. And very interesting, the Meyer material talks about these Giza intelligences. It kind of all fits together in a strange sort of way, don't you think, Nate?
Yeah, actually, if you think of it from a business point of view, it seems like your business model. It's what they have their mission statement, and their mission statement is the Jesus story, the resurrection story, and they sewed that story in all these cultures, and like, you know, an extraterrestrial from the same group goes, okay, I'm gonna just put different names in the story and just put it down here, and these will be my people that I will rule, and I don't have to do too much work. It's like, you know, and that's what it kind of appears. You stand back and you think of it like a business, like they're, you know, or, you know, a pattern. You can definitely see that there, and they didn't, and if they have something that's good, that's working, you know, here they are dominating people for hundreds and thousands of years. You know, why change a good thing?
And it still has such an impact today. That's the part that amazes me.
Yeah, and if they would have just understood about the law of reincarnation, they wouldn't. I mean, I don't know if this stuff would have happened. Like, you know, I mean, did that not concern them? What do they think? You know, I'm going to make a lot of people slaves and stuff, but I will reincarnate. How will you reincarnate? Where will you reincarnate? You know, but I mean, because they've taken it from these, you know, wise and holy men, and they must have read it. They must have known what they were covering up. It says even in the Meyer material that that in the early Christianity that they had changed the any reference or any passages that refer to reincarnation. If we as a people could just get that point across, dealing with fundamentalism and stuff like this, do you really want to let fundamentalism grow? I think people are like at the point that they'll allow things like which are seemingly way outside of their scope. You know, for example, ISIS, right? It's way outside of their scope. It's too big. You can't stop it. Blah, blah, blah. It's okay because I'm going to heaven, you know. You know, and they never say I'm going to hell. They always say I'm going to heaven, by the way. And they always tell you that you're going to hell. but they're convinced of this. I mean, one of my wishful thinkings is that you know, we can, maybe our science can get to that point where we can measure the energy lifting off the body in some effect. And come with proof to the table about reincarnation, because as far as I'm concerned, I think, you know, there's only on the fringe of science does it actually consider that a possibility, and it makes perfect logical sense, because everything we see is in a constant state of forming and deforming.
You know, what's so interesting, and this is a recent study that I've talked about before, but I think it's important to repeat this, and that is the creation of the letter J. And this goes to show you, see, we have the mindset, and still I'm reeling from this, and I'm trying to wrap my mind around the significance of it. We have in our minds that these scriptures have been passed down for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and they've never been modified, and they're the Word of God, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when I came across this, it was mind-blowing, because I have a Christian background. I spent a lot of time studying the Bible, even considered being a pastor. And then I come across this, that the letter J is the youngest letter of the alphabet. And the letter J never existed until about the year 1600 in the English language. Now, why is that significant? That means what they did when they translated into English is all of these names of these Old Testament and New Testament figures that began with an I or a Y, they went in and they substituted the letter J and the J sound. So they had the audacity to go in and change all of these scriptures. Let me give you an example. The book of Job was originally called the book of Iob. Dude, you know, I mean, who would think to change something like that? And Jesus in the Greek was known as Iesus. If you look at the old paintings of the crucifixion, either on the top or on the bottom, they have I-N-R-I. And it's Iesus Nazarenus, which we would say Jesus of Nazarene, Rex Iorium, which means Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Well, he was never called Jesus at the time. He was never called Jesus until the second version of the 1611 King James Bible came out, where they first printed it with all the I's in it. For example, the Apostle John was like the Apostle Ionis. Not John. His name wasn't John. So they went in and they completely changed all this stuff. Now, I hope it wasn't completely arbitrary. I hope there was some kind of logic about it. But the letter J was invented. It was created by Gian Giorgio Trissino right around 1500s, 1520, 1530. And he explicitly distinguished between the I and the J as separate sounds. And he did that in the Middle High German. And eventually that went to the French and went to the English. It appeared in the English right around the 1600s. So if you were to argue that there was no historical person named Jesus Christ, you would be technically correct, because he was not called Jesus at that time. Now, that goes to show you how they've changed these scriptures over the years. That was one of the big sticking points for me for the Meyer material, and I just kind of put it up there on the shelf, didn't know what to do with it. Because how in the world could we be wrong about the central figure of Western society? How could we not know his name? Well, it turns out that we didn't know his name. And it's interesting, according to Meyer information, his name was Emmanuel. And Nate, you are actually sponsoring the translation of the Book of Emmanuel. Is that correct?
Yeah. Jim Deerdorf recently passed away. And he was one of the, I think it was because of him, it was actually brought to the attention of the Western U.S., the Talmud Emmanuel, that is. And, I have my beginnings in Christianity as well. And I just, you know, when I discovered the Meyer material earlier on, I was just like, it was like a breath of fresh air, or or I would say not even a breath, a river you could jump into and just go. So, I mean, go ahead.
Did you feel any shock? I felt a little bit of a shock. It was kind of like, wow, what is this?
Yeah, actually, a lot of it had to do with washing away my beliefs that were entrenched in me, just certain ones. Like, for example, when Billy went back in time and talked with Emmanuel, for example. You know, when you first start reading this stuff and then you get to that, you're just like, all right, I got to put it down for a while.
Exactly. I hear you.
Okay, so, you know, but, I mean, that taught me how to think. Yes, I'm not believing that he did that. Understand that I'm actually just, I have it in a place of data. And if there's something that transpired in that conversation that I could use to further my evolution, I will. Or to help other people further their evolution, I will. Because the question to me at that point, like, it's like, you know, question is like, wait a second. So I mean, here's something that's so far out, and that here I am taught about these other stuff that's so far out. And I've adapted one far out ism, and I'm looking at another far out ism. I'm like, oh, that's just BS. You know, I'm just, wait a second, what is my foundation for even saying that? You know.
Oh, I hear what you're saying. That's so true.
And I mean, here's the rationale. Like, when I got in trouble, my mom would force me to read the Beatitudes. And they if you're young and you have a rational thinking or a logical thinking or like math or something, and you read something like Beatitudes, it just makes you want to pull your hair out and do more bad things. But one in particular thing, I'll read the one that came from Matthew and the other one that came from the Talmud. Matthew 5:3, it says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Okay, I don't know how that's even workable. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs are the kingdom of heaven. I asked my mom what she thought poor meant, and she said, "Oh, it means you're rich. It means you're humble, but you're rich in spirit. And heaven is yours." And I'm just like, okay. I think of it, you know, thinking from like a cynical point of view, I would say that those that are poor in spirit lack rationale, lack cognition, lack truth, will fall for an idea such as heaven.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, how could you define heaven? And how can anyone tell us where it's at?
That's true too, and the Talmud version to that same verse says, "Blessed are those who are rich in spirit and recognize the truth, for life is theirs." That's pretty straightforward, and there's not an appeal to a magical place called heaven, and there's not an idea of being poor. Remember, this was taken over by the plutocracy at the time, and which is a bunch of rich people ruling the poor, and they had to continually any type of self empowerment they had to weed out of their teachings, any type of reference to, you know, equal footing. And so they would always go back to poor. You know, it's cool to be poor because you're going to get heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they even have that one saying, it's easier for a rich man. It's easier for a camel to enter the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I mean, what? But I mean, this going on, and the people saying this to you oftentimes are read, and you know, we're talking about these ministers and these people that claim to be, you know, close to God and stuff, but all they are themselves are con artists, and you got this hypnotic flock in front of them, and I mean, if you can just, even you pick up your book and you say, well, this guy's not going to heaven because he's rich, but I'm poor because I gave him everything I have, so I'm going. And meanwhile, he's laughing his way to the bank. I mean, just on that premise alone, you should kind of turn and walk away.
But it doesn't seem to work that way, does it?
Absolutely not. I mean, how do we get through to people that are hypnotized? You know,
I think it takes time, Nate. I think it takes a lot of time, and I think it takes them time, because what they have to do is slowly address it in a personal way over time, and they have to deal with the cognitive dissonance. Because at some point, the old common sense is going to wake up in their mind, and it's going to conflict with their religious notions. And they're going to have to resolve that cognitive dissonance and that ambivalence themselves. And that takes a lot of time.
Especially where there's like groups of people that they get together and they all have the same ridiculous notion of being chosen ones or having special or being, you know, special somehow.
Indeed. I mean, that's very, very true. I have our old trusty clip here that talks about the letter J. I wanted to play a little bit of it. I think it's worth listening to again.
J is the youngest letter of the alphabet. The letter J is roughly 500 years old and was not part of the ancient Greek, Hebrew, or Latin alphabets. By way of contrast, the ampersand, a combination of the letters E and T, is 2,000 years old. The oldest letter is O, which has been with us for 3,000 years. J descended figuratively and literally from the letter I and was used to give a consonant sound to the letter I. Consider how the letter A sounds differently depending on the word it is used in, baby or bath, for instance. At one time, I might have been used to sound both like I or like J. Important political and religious figures whose names started with the letter I lived before the invention of the letter J, and today their names are commonly spelled with a J rather than with an I. Julius Caesar was born in approximately 100 B.C. and Jesus Christ was born in approximately 5 B.C. Some scholars believe that names that began with I were pronounced as if they began with Y, and pronunciations evolved over time. To some people, there are religious implications in the spelling of religious names. Of course, there are no recordings from these time periods, and scholars must rely on ancient texts for guidance. Any books written before 1600 had no J's as we know them. In 1455, Johannes Gutenberg invented movable type, which some consider humankind's greatest invention. Gutenberg's first name likely started with I because he was born before J's were used. Copies of the Gutenberg Bible still exist, and in it Job, for instance, was spelled I-O-B. Similarly, the 1611 edition of the King James Bible had no J's, but 1769 editions of the King James Bible had J's. Some credit Italian playwright and scholar Gian Giorgio Cicino, who was born in 1478, for the official split of I from J. Cicino wrote that the consonant J should be a distinct letter from the vowel I. Similarly, Cicino wrote that the vowel U should be separate from the consonant V. Both ideas grew in popularity, and thus we have J's and U's.
I really like that clip talking about the history of the letter J. I have another one here that tell us a little about hypnosis. And as soon as this one finishes, we'll go ahead and play that one.
Just let yourself go.
Just focus on the problem.
Hypnotherapy is used by over 500,000 people in Britain.
Imagine your eyelids becoming heavy.
It's claimed it can make you thinner.
It does work.
Stop you smoking.
I just go deep and deep.
Do almost anything. Accessing the powers of your unconscious mind to increase the size and shape of your breath. Marvelous. I set out to explore hypnotherapy. I've seen hypnosis in action. But can it really make us do anything? Should I believe what I see? Could it affect our health and behavior? I've watched people as they set out with huge hopes, putting more trust in it than I could have imagined.
Everything is being peeled off.
It's not something I ever thought I'd try. This is my journey. This is me, Kathy Sykes, Professor of Sciences and Society at the University of Bristol. I've always found the idea of being hypnotized spooky, and to be honest, I didn't really know what it was. You hear that it involves our unconscious mind, whatever that is.
Well, you know, I think we are hypnotized more than we realize. We're hypnotized by religion. We're also hypnotized by the television to a certain degree. It seems that we're getting, our consciousness is under a whole lot more attack than we realize, and particularly now in the schools, they are putting in a curriculum which seems also more aimed at slowing down people's consciousness evolution. Have you come across that yet at all, Nate, since you have a daughter?
Oh, yes. That and the whole recent measure that's trying to be passed here with the whole forced vaccination thing. I don't have, along that note, I don't have my child vaccinated for anything. Because I did a lot of research, and I just really just want to see the evidence put in front of me as I looked at a lot of this stuff. You know, I met so much resistance with a lot of people, and it's, you know, every argument in the book is thrown at you, but most of it is, you know, deals with the fallacy of ad hominem, which is just, they attack me. They call me a child killer and all kinds of things. But it doesn't make sense that a human life form would be going through millions and millions of years of evolution and then somehow be susceptible to every prick and infection or disease, now that life form is at the mercy of some liquid concoction they have to put in them. And what people don't realize is that, you know, along this, I know I'm tangenting right now, but bear with me.
No, that's okay.
Along this note, you know, vaccination is not immunization. It's not inoculation. It's vaccination, and it's theoretical at best. If you go and you do the research on the guy who invented it, you know, total con guy. And let me just summarize his story. His name is Jenner. I forgot what his last name was, or maybe that is his last name, Dr. Jenner, or not even a doctor. But it happened to be at the end of the measles, or the, not the measles, the smallpox outbreak, he was looking for a way to he purports to be looking for a way to cure something, to cure this, and so he sees these cow maidens, and they would be milking the cow for many hours of the day and stuff, and where their hands would be raw and stuff. They had like these growths on their hands, kind of maybe a sort of I would like to say, like, warts, types of warts and stuff. On the cow, the udders of the cow had these pus, these growths, these, like, it had the, I don't know, just white blisters on them and stuff. And this Jenner guy goes, well, these handmaidens didn't seem to get smallpox. So there's the cure. So he took the pus from the cow, and he found a woman who was very poor, and she had a son, and he offered them money to inject the kid with this cow pus. So he injected the kid with the cow pus, and boom, there you go. You have the cure for smallpox. And if people really, like, think about that logically or rationally, how insane, insidious that is, you know?
It is insane. It's beyond belief. And it's, you're right. I never thought of it that way. It is an attack on our consciousness. Just like the hypnosis is an attack on our consciousness. Because when you take those vaccines, you're bringing in all kinds of heavy metals, aluminum, mercury, and all kinds of things. Like, some of these vaccines use, well, things like human fetal tissue and monkey kidneys and all sorts of things. That's what they put those viruses in, to kind of keep them so they don't go rancid. So you're injecting all kinds of weird foreign DNA into your bodies. And that has to happen. That has to have a terrible effect on your mind. It really slows down children's natural development.
It's right, and just only up until I think 2011 is when they took it out. But they had thimerosal. For some reason, the sickness that permeates humanity just loves putting poison. And I look at it as a very sick, cruel joke played by people with very sick and demented minds. Like, when I was little, there was this kid across the street, and he was a real jerk. But there's these other poor kids that were living, and one of the poor kids saw that this kid had a lollipop, and he's like, okay, I'll give you the lollipop, but I'm going to put it in shit first, and then I'll give it to you, you know? And that's exactly, he put in some dog crap, and they gave it to him, you know, the poor kid just, I guess he couldn't wash it off, and then he's like, okay, I'll wash it off. But the point is, this is like a kid's mentality, a very sick little kid's mentality, you know, that needs to be corrected. And I see them, like, they're like laughing all the way to the bank, because not only are they feeding us poison, but they're making money off of it. They're making tons of money off of it. Just, I don't know, people are just, and then this whole fluoride trip in the water, it's just, it's absolutely, I don't know, it's just, you look at all, anybody that questions that fluoride is bad for them, just go, you know, just go pick up your local, or from your local store, the fluoride toothpaste they have over there, and turn on the back of the toothpaste. It will say, if your child is below six and they or under the age of six and they swallow less than, you know, the tip of my pinky finger of this stuff, contact poison control immediately. Okay, that's how dangerous this stuff is.
Yeah.
And
a lot of us believed what we were told. A lot of us believed that it was good for us. A lot of us believed it was good for our teeth. We could never imagine that our leaders would intentionally put fluoride in our water unless it was good for us. Well, here we now, we find out much, much later that, in fact, it isn't good for us at all. And as Nate was saying, it's poisonous. It's a little less poisonous than arsenic, and it's more poisonous than lead. And they used to, They used to use it in the concentration camps, particularly in Germany, because it kind of makes people sedate.
Okay, which would play to their narrative of this crap down education that they're feeding our children, or they even feed us these types. They don't want the individual because the individual, you know, is to them the individual is the enemy because they can't control the individual. They can't have the individual as a slave, you know, for whatever reason. They're addicted to having slaves, whoever they are, or this mentality. And what's really sad about a lot of this is that you have slaves will lash out and attack you if you try to think for yourself.
They will.
In any situation.
They will. That's so true. And they almost police their own ranks, don't they?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, you said in the beginning that you're talking about belief and you're going over a list from the book The Might of Thoughts, and I think one of them was being inconsiderate. Is that there's like a lack of consideration for your next human being over.
You know, but when it's all said and done, I think we need to make sure that we don't have lower thoughts, because our lower thoughts form lower feelings and then lower habits and then eventually lower circumstances. So we want to have neutral, positive thoughts. We want to have higher thoughts. Because if we continue to have lower thoughts and lower habits and we'll eventually get lower feelings and then lower circumstances, which can lead to alcoholism, hate, which can lead to resentment, sorrow, grief, bitterness, and many kinds of suffering. So you need to keep sure and keep looking at your consciousness. Remember, your consciousness is just like a garden. You need to go in there and reach out and pull out those weeds before they wildly grow and destroy your whole world of thoughts, because a positive, good thoughts will form good habits and good circumstances and good experiences, and you'll have cheerfulness and moderateness and self-control, and you'll be constructive. And you can strengthen your own calmness, your own love, your own peace. And it will help your whole immune system. And remember, your thoughts are contagious. And you can pass on these good thoughts to others. And really, the primary commandment, the primary creational natural law is love. And love is the absolute certainty that we exist with all things, with all flora, with all fauna, with all people. And true love comes from the spirit, from the Gemut. And it's a spiritual thing. It's not romantic. It's wisdom-conditioned love. And the whole creation radiates love. Love is the highest principle in creation. And I always tell people, take the time, if you're not fortunate like me, and I can sit on my back porch and be right there observing the beauty of creation. And if you're not in that good of a circumstance, take the time to go out of the city and go into nature and develop and find it. Develop that fine, sensitive feeling and develop that sense of oneness with all things. And then you'll naturally develop a sense of calm. And you'll naturally develop a sense of stability and love. And you might just zone out for a while. And you'll go neutral. And you'll go empty. And you'll listen. Particularly if you're out there in the evenings or out there when the sun comes up, and you'll listen to nature, and you'll hear, you know, the cicadas, you'll hear the frogs, the peepers, all the various kinds of birds singing, and you'll watch the beauty of creation. And you'll strengthen your immune system, and you'll bring yourself back to a state, a neutral, positive, balanced, equalized state. And you'll start to sense the oneness with all things and the beauty of creation. And what did Sloth tell Billy? Well, we're really all one and we're bound together. And that life is part of a cycle. And we see the cycle in nature, the life and death cycle. So there's no fear of death. There should be no fear of death. Because, you know, like it says in the Goblet of Truth, rivers, lakes, streams, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involve many, many lifetimes. And you have many, many lifetimes. And you need to recognize that you're part of all things. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. I want to thank Nate for joining me. I want to thank all of you for listening. Have a good evening.